From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war.
Actor Danny Glover breaking the sound barrier as he comes under attack for criticizing military tribunals and the death penalty. We'll hear from a group of courageous artists who've come together to speak out for peace. Danny Glover, Susan Sarandon, Eve Ensler, Sonia Sanchez, among others. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New questions have been raised about the fate and whereabouts of Osama bin Laden after his face appeared on Qatar television yesterday. The Al Jazeera station ran a preview of yet another videotape of Osama bin Laden, which will be run by the network in its entirety today. Dressed in green military fatigues, a pale and gaunt bin Laden said he was speaking, quote, 3 months after the blessed attack against the international infidels and its leaders, the United States, and 2 months after the beginning of the vicious aggression against Islam, unquote. Several people, including Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf, have speculated that Osama bin Laden may have been killed in the U.S. bombing of the caves. Others believe he may have slipped away, possibly crossing the border into Pakistan. Still others say he may still be in Afghanistan. The U.S. War Department said it's not immediately sure what to make of the videotape showing bin Laden alive, possibly as recently as 2 weeks ago. As for the former Taliban leader, Mullah Mohammed Omar, Afghanistan's new interim president, Hamid Karzai, says he believes that Omar is still in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in separate news, Karzai has declared his support for U.S.-led coalition troops to continue to hunt al-Qaeda leaders and bring them to trial. Karzai's government, which met for the second time yesterday, is pushing to put a multinational army in place as soon as possible. Afghanistan currently has no official army. Afghan officials insist it's unlikely that the Afghan government would lose tolerance for the continuing U.S. military presence, which includes B-52 bombers and other warplanes in the skies and U.S. Marines and special forces on the ground. But Afghan officials shed little light over continuing questions of U.S. warplanes' destruction of a convoy of cars last week in the eastern province of Paktia. U.S. military officials say those killed were al-Qaeda members, but there are persistent reports from local people that the dead were tribal leaders on their way to the new government of Afghanistan's inaugural ceremony. This follows by weeks the attack on the new leader, Hamid Karzai's headquarters, just an hour or two before he was named the head of the interim government in Bonn, Germany. As soldiers mass along the border with Pakistan, India has dismissed steps Pakistan has taken to clamp down on two radical groups that India blames for the attack on the Indian parliament earlier this month. Indian officials have accused Pakistan of giving financial and logistical support to the groups, both based in Pakistan. And the U.S. has added the two groups to the State Department's list of terrorists, prompting Pakistani authorities to freeze the group's assets and arrest one of their founders. War fever keeps rising in India for the first time in its 54 years. As an independent nation, the army has canceled the Army Day parades that were to be held in cities across India on January 15th. Instead, the guns, the tanks, the thousands of troops will be deployed along India's more than 2,000-mile-long border with Pakistan. Meanwhile, Secretary of State General Colin Powell has telephoned leaders in India and Pakistan. He's been urging them to calm the tensions that have continued to mount since the attack on India's parliament that left at least 14 people dead. According to remarks made by NATO Secretary General this week, NATO might support military action against Iraq. Buoyed by military success in Afghanistan, there is a growing chorus of American officials now advocating Saddam Hussein to be the next target. Others say that that action against Iraq could be dangerous, if only because it may break up the so-called international coalition against terrorism forged after the September 11th attacks. The chief prosecutor of the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal, The Hague, has said she's convinced there's now evidence of the former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic to be convicted of genocide. Carla Del Ponte, the chief prosecutor, renewed her call for Slobodan Milosevic to face trial on charges of war crimes in Kosovo, Bosnia, and Croatia at the same time, an idea recently rejected by tribunal judges. The head of a London mosque confirmed today that the man who threatened to blow up a passenger plane with explosives hidden in his shoe is a small-time British criminal who converted to Islam in prison and was later lured to radical action. Abdulhaq Bakr, chair of the Brixton Mosque and Islamic Cultural Center in South London, identified the suspect as a man who took the name Abdul Rahim when he began worshiping there in late 1995 after serving time for minor offenses. The passport he used to board the plane on Saturday identified him as Richard Reed. Though the Brixton Mosque has regularly condemned violence, today's development marked the second time that people linked to international terror have been traced back to it. Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker and the only man charged in the U.S. with conspiring in the September 11th attacks, attended services there in the late 1990s.
You can't depend on your family. You can't depend on your friend. You can't depend on them. Can't depend on a beginning, and oh, you can't depend on no end. You can't depend on intelligence. Can't depend on God, you can depend on only one thing, man. You got a busload of faith, you need a busload of faith, you need a busload of faith to get by, by, by. Busload of faith to get by. Busload of faith to get by.
Busload of faith, Lou Reed, here on the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. Still outside the firehouse, where we have our studios in the garret, is an Army Humvee. Soldiers, National Guard, police continue to stop vehicles or other people in this area as they walk down closer to Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, it looks like actor Danny Glover has become one of the latest victims of the war on free speech after he publicly criticized the use of military tribunals. On November 16th, at the invitation of the local Amnesty International chapter, Danny Glover gave a speech about the death penalty to a packed auditorium at Princeton University. While the speech was enthusiastically received at first, it became the subject of controversy when, following the lecture, a young person asked the actor whether he would extend his opposition to the death penalty to Osama bin Laden. Glover affirmed his opposition to the death penalty in all circumstances. The provocative exchange continued, with Danny Glover noting that America has been a key purveyor of violence in the world. Danny Glover also voiced his objections to military tribunals that President Bush has created. These comments have elicited a hailstorm of outrage from some. For 2 weeks, the Trentonian newspaper ran angry comments suggesting that if Danny Glover didn't love this country, he should leave it. Meanwhile, Oliver North broadcast the story across the country on his Radio America show, urging his audience to boycott The Royal Tenenbaums, a movie that was released last Friday in which Danny Glover stars alongside other prominent actors. More recently, in Modesto, California, the controversy caused the city council there to withdraw its sponsorship of Danny Glover as the featured speaker for the celebration of Martin Luther King Day. Well, today we're going to go to a performance of Danny Glover as he read a speech of Dr. Martin Luther King. It was at an event at the New York Society for Ethical Culture called Mother Courage, Imagining Peace, and it was in support of the women and children of Afghanistan, an event sponsored by MADRE, an international women's human rights organization, and it took place on December 10th. After all of this news came out about Danny Glover, we thought, what better time to run Danny Glover reading the speech of Martin Luther King. And in addition, for this hour, we will hear from many others as they participate in this event called Imagining Peace. People like Eve Ensler, Sonia Sanchez, Susan Sarandon. So take a listen as we begin with Danny Glover.
A time to break the silence. Martin Luther King Jr., April 4th, 1967, Riverside Church, New York City. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexed as they often do in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate in our limited vision, but we must speak, and we must rejoice as well. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seems as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the buildup in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken and eviscerated as if it were some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as its ventures, like Vietnam, continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in an extraordinarily high proportions to the rest of the population. We were taking black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia or East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on television screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same school. So we watched them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized that they would never live on the same block in Detroit. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak for those whose land has been laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative means of protest possible.
That was Danny Glover reading the speech given by Martin Luther King Jr. at Riverside Church, April 4th, 1967. Now to Susan Sarandon reading How We Did It by Muriel Rukeyser at an event sponsored by MADRE in support of women and children of Afghanistan called Mother Courage, Imagining Peace.
How We Did It by Muriel Rukeyser. We all traveled into that big room, some from very far away. We smiled at some we knew. We did not talk, as we talked, agree. Our hearts went fast thinking of morning when we would walk along the path. We spoke late night. We disagreed. We knew that we would climb the Senate steps. We knew we would present our claim. We would demand, be strong now, end the war. How would we do it? What would we ask? We will be warned, one said. They will warn us and take us away. We can speak and walk away. We could lie down as if in mourning. We can lie down as a way of speech, speaking of all the dead in Asia. Then Iqbal said, we are not at this moment a revolutionary group. We are a group of dissenters. Let some then walk away. Let some stand until they want to leave. Let some lie down and let some be arrested. Some of us. Let each do what he feels at the moment. Tomorrow. Iqbal's dark face. The doctor spoke of friendships made in jail. We looked into each other's eyes and went all to our rooms to sleep, waiting for morning.
Susan Sarandon reading Muriel Rukeyser's How We Did It. Now to Monica Aleman.
I am the Palestinian women, the Israeli women. We are cousins. How do I imagine? Memory, holding history, too harsh to taste. How do I speak my language? Invent a new one. Each syllable, a volcano, reconfiguring the earth. Each syllable, the recovery. A pause. If I say what I know, will you still listen? And can I still live in my body then? How do I imagine? My two hearts, one belly, voice of blood, a just geography. In this room, this year, start here. Home, olive, name, city, earth, language, coffee, wine, water, school, work, travel, no passport, ID card, imagine. We can acknowledge this pause, a moment without fear. I know I cannot say everything here. No women can. My wide hips carry sticks for fire. Turned villages, secrets, poems, my children's dream wrap in this anxious skirt. All things are not the same. That's all I can say today in this room. But I am here to imagine.
And that was Monica Aleman. When we come back from break, Eve Ensler on I've Been Thinking About Violence, Tony Kushner from Mother Courage by Bertolt Brecht, and Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon read from Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez's letter that didn't get published in the newspaper but went around the internet. Their son, Greg Ernesto, died above the 100th floor of the World Trade Center, and they pleaded with President Bush, not in our son's name, not in our name, don't bomb Afghanistan. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. These cultural workers and artists gathered for a Madre event to benefit the women and children of Afghanistan. Madre online is madre.org, and you can get all contacts at our website, democracynow.org. We'll go back to Imagining Peace in just a minute here on the War and Peace Report.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life.
On Children, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Khalil Gibran's poetry and music. You're listening to the War and Peace Report as we go back to Mother Courage Imagining Peace, an event that was sponsored by Madre, an international women's human rights organization in support of the women and children of Afghanistan. The event included Danny Glover, Susan Sarandon, Sonia Sanchez, and others. We begin with Eve Ensler. She wrote this piece and performed it. I've been thinking about violence.
I have been thinking about violence. I have been thinking about an airplane full of terrified women and men and children smashing into a tower full of unsuspecting women and men who were just sipping their morning coffee. I've been thinking about the burning people jumping from the 100th floor, jumping for their lives. I've been thinking about the hundreds of firemen and policemen who were lost, crushed under a collapsing tower. I've been thinking about a husband waiting in his office for 14 hours for his wife, who worked on the 104th floor, who had not called, who was probably never going to call, and yet he was still waiting. I was thinking of the man who called his mother from the hijacked plane to tell her he loved her, to remember he loved her. I've been thinking about the debris and the dust on New Yorkers' shoes and how shocked we are here in America, how protected we've been. I've been thinking about all the war-torn countries I have been to, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and the dust on the people's shoes and the debris. I've been thinking about the people who were driven to hijack airplanes with knives and box cutters, who were driven to hijack airplanes, who were ready, eager to lose their lives to hurt other people. I've been thinking about violence, what it feels like to be nothing to someone else, what it feels like to be a consequence of someone else's disassociated rage, disconnected fury. I've been thinking about the cycle of hurt for hurt, nation against nation, tit for tat. I've been thinking about the courage it requires to think about something else.
That was Eve Ensler. Now to
I've been thinking about the courage it requires to think about something other than violence as a response to violence. I am thinking about the complexity of this and the loneliness of this and the helplessness and the sorrow that would be felt in the space where violence was once was and the grief. I've been thinking that for those of us who are living on the planet right here, right now, nothing less will do if we want to go on as a species. That we must live in this dangerous space, allowing the helplessness, the grief, the sorrow to create new wisdom that can and will and must free us from this terrible world of violence. I urge you, each one of you, fall into this space. Weep. Be lost. Let go. Die into the grief. On the other side, it will be revealed.
Now to playwright Toni Kushner from Eve Ensler reading her piece, I've Been Thinking About Violence.
This is the opening scene, just two speeches from the opening scene of Mother Courage and Her Children by Bertolt Brecht. As Professor Eric Bentley points out in a famous essay on the play, the first audience to hear these speeches in a theater was an audience in Berlin in 1946. It's two soldiers, a recruiting officer and a sergeant, who are standing near a town. And the recruiting officer is complaining, "How's a soldier supposed to gather recruits in a place like this? I'm thinking of killing myself, Sergeant. Order comes from the general staff's 4 fresh companies in 2 weeks' time. And the people here are so rude. They're vicious. I've got insomnia. Imagine, if you will, some jerk, concave chest, varicose veins. I overlook all that. I buy him beers till he's shit-faced. He signs up, and then I'm paying the tab at the bar. He's off to take a leak. He says, I keep an eye on him because I've learned the smell of a rat. And sure enough, zip, out the door like a silverfish when the lamp's lit. Honor, loyalty, duty, God, forget it. A place like this makes you lose your belief in the inner goodness of man, Sergeant." The sergeant responds, "The problem is, these people have gone too long without a war. So of course they're sleazy. No war, no decency, ethics, morality. Peacetime, everything gets rotten. War purifies and organizes. Peace comes, people become rutting animals, screwing one another, screwing the livestock. Nobody gives a damn. Everybody gets fat in peacetime. Oh, I think I'll just sit down now and eat a big cheese and fat sandwich on a nice slice of fresh white bread. Do you think those people there know how many young men and horses they've got in that town? It's peace. Why count? I've been in some towns so godforsaken, they've even had 70 years without war. The people haven't even bothered naming their children. Nobody knows whose was whose. You need a good, stiff war to get people counting and listing and naming. Shoes in nice big piles, corn in bags for carrying off, each man and each cow tagged and inventoried. War makes order, and order makes war." And the recruiting sergeant says, "Hear, hear." The sergeant finishes up, "Sure, it's tough work starting a war. Anything worthwhile is tough. But once you get a war on its feet, blam, it runs away from you. Sloppy, lazy, peaceful people turn into savages. They throttle, rape, and mutilate peace like they were afraid if they stopped they'd have to think about how much blood there is. It's invigorating. It's an invigorating change from the ordinary. It's exciting, war is. These people need a good war."
Toni Kushner, playwright, reading from Mother Courage by Bertolt Brecht. Now to Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon, reading the letter to President Bush from Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, who lost their son, Greg Ernesto Rodriguez, in the World Trade Center.
"Dear President Bush, our son is one of the victims of Tuesday's attack on the World Trade Center. We read about your response in the last few days and about the solutions from both the resolutions from both houses giving you undefined power to respond to the terror attacks.
Your response to this attack does not make us feel better about our son's death. It makes us feel worse.
It makes us feel that our government is using our son's memory as a justification to cause suffering for other sons and parents in other lands.
It's not the first time that a person in your position has been given unlimited power and came to regret it.
This is not the time for empty gestures to make us feel better.
It is not the time to act like bullies.
We urge you to think about how our government can develop peaceful, rational solutions to terrorism.
Solutions that do not sink us.
Sink us to the inhumane level of terrorists.
Sincerely, Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez.
Saturday, September 15th, 2001.
That was Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon. Now to a performance by Carol Maillard and Nadine Mozon with Cooper Moore on piano, Time, Grace, and the Courage to Love.
Mother, 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 there's far too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there is far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, Father, 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 we don't need to escalate. War is not the answer, 'cause only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today, 'cause these are trying times. Try, 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 try times. I'm talking about trying times. It's what the world is talking about. You got confusion, 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 confusion all over the land. You got mother against daughter. You got father against son. The whole thing is getting out of hand. But you know that folks, they wouldn't never have to suffer if there was more love for your sister and your brother. But you know I'm trying to tell you, these are trying times. Trying times.
The trick to trying times is trying to imagine otherwise. Once you've been force-fed the unfathomable, the bitter bile of disbelief heightened by defeat may daunt your will to meditate on better times. Curb your appetite to swallow something sweet. The trick to trying times is trying to dare trust the ultimate reign of good as good enough to override disheartening dust. Dust that rains despair and blurs your hungry gaze.
More love, more love, more love. Hey, hey.
The trick to trying times is mastering a mind to feel secure while not a single soul can pledge to keep you safe. Military might may not incite the kind of faith you want to count on. Life's cycles and seasons deliver reliable wonders we all have come to count on. Another day revealing itself to all who enter. Breath coming and going, respecting destiny's flow. A chance to know love's deep mystery and majesty embedded in the passage of time. The trick to the passage of time is not getting mired in a grave moment. Though a moment can leave us forever changed, no moment should leave us forever lingering, lacking access to time's natural motion. Each of our lives, positioned in time, share a pivotal date with
Nadine Mozon, Carol Maillard with Cooper Moore, Time, Grace, and the Courage to Love. Their performance at the Mother Courage Imagining Peace performance at the New York Society for Ethical Culture that was sponsored by MADRE, an international women's human rights organization in support of the women and children of Afghanistan. We're going to continue now with Danny Glover reading James Baldwin's letter to my nephew on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation. Danny Glover.
From my dungeon shook. James Baldwin. Letter to my nephew on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation. Dear James, I have begun this letter 5 times and torn it up 5 times. I keep seeing your face, which is also the face of your father and my brother. I know what the world has done to my brother and how narrowly he has survived it. And I know which is much worse, and this is the crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen, and for which neither I, nor time, nor history will ever forgive them, that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds and thousands of lives and do not know it or do not want to know it. One can be, indeed one must strive to become tough and philosophical concerning destruction and death. And this is what most of mankind had been best at since we have heard of man. But remember, most of mankind is not all of mankind. But it is not permissible that the authors of devastation should also be innocent. It is the innocence which constitutes the crime. Now, my dear namesake, these innocent and well-meaning people, your countrymen, have caused you to be born under conditions not very far removed from those described for us by Charles Dickens in the London of more than 100 years ago. His innocent country set you down in the ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. You have, and many of us have, defeated this intention, and by a terrible law, a terrible paradox, those innocent who believe that your imprisonment made them safe are losing their grasp on reality. But these men are your brothers, your lost younger brothers. And if the word integration means anything, this is what it means, that we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they are, to cease fleeing from reality and begin to change it. For this is your home, my friend. Do not be driven from it. Great men have done great things here and will again. And we can make America what America must become. It is very hard, James, but you come from sturdy peasant stock, men who pick cotton and dam rivers and build railroads and in the teeth of the most terrifying odds, achieved an unassailable and monumental dignity. You come from a long line of great poets, some of the greatest poets since Homer. One of them said, "The very time I thought I was lost, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off." You know, and I know, that the country is celebrating 100 years of freedom, 100 years too soon. We cannot be free until they are free. God bless you, James, and Godspeed. Your uncle, James.
Danny Glover reading James Baldwin's letter to my nephew on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation at the Madre event on December 10th, 2001. And we're going to go back to that event with historian Blanche Wieson Cook and poet Sonia Sanchez in just a minute. Here on the War and Peace Report, visit our website at democracynow.org and also Madres at madre.org. Stay with us.
Yesterday, today.
George Harrison here on the War and Peace Report, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to the Madre event, Mother Courage Imagining Peace in support of the women and children of Afghanistan, to Gail Jackson and her own letter to her nephew, dear nephew.
Chris, this comes with your grandfather Jackson's flag. Dear nephew, dearest little one, you stood so tall and loving beside me today at the funeral of my father, one of your grandfathers. So it seems right that you should take my father's flag to carry on, though to bear this standard is not a simple thing for a black man. For the black man, for the African American. And today I hand a little boy the job of a man. This flag barely contains its complicated story. For the black man, for the African American, this flag is the symbol of both a hope and a betrayal, a dream of freedom and the reality of our slavery, our faith, and our disenfranchisement in this country. Our people built this nation with their dreams. After this land was stolen from the indigenous people, after so many were slaughtered, after they, African people, came here and lived here in chains, still our people dreamed about freedom. Our people dreamed over the graves of their Native American brothers and sisters and over the graves of their countrymen and women who died in chains. Our people dreamed looking back over the sea which separated them from the motherland and the watery graves where so many Africans had chosen to drown rather than live as slaves. Our people, our ancestors saw many horrible things, still they dreamed. Theirs was an ancient human dream, older than any flag or any nation that might enslave them. And when they took up this flag as a banner for their dream, they knew, as we know now, that the liberty and justice which is central to this flag's promise did not, does not yet exist. But they had faith in their dream, in the human aspiration for democracy and freedom, and they have fought since the very beginning of this national gathering called the United States of America. They have fought to make that dream, those ideas, that symbol a reality. Through them, the blood in the red stripes of this flag is your own. You know that Crispus Attucks, a runaway slave, a seaman, an African American, was the first to shed blood in the colonial revolt from England. Thousands of black men fought for American independence, but still there was no freedom. So we kept fighting. You know that Harriet Tubman made 100 trips to liberate people from slave territory, that she served as a spy for the Union Army, that they called her General Harriet Tubman. 200,000 black troops bore this flag to end slavery. Still, the nation would not embrace the dream. So we kept fighting. Each time this country has called upon those who would stand for democracy and freedom, our people have stood and fought with distinction, passing that dream and that fight down through the generations like the wounded flag bearer passes the flag to the next person who takes it up and keeps it going. Your grandfather Jackson fought in World War II. In Rome, in Arno, in North Apennes, in Po Valley, was wounded more than once and received the Purple Heart, fighting for the double victory, fighting against fascism, fighting for that cherished dream. But he fought in a segregated unit. White prisoners of war received better treatment from the United States government than 1 million black men serving their native land. They were among the best and the bravest, but they were never honored for their service. And when those African American soldiers returned from war, when your grandfather Jackson returned from war, there was still no justice for the black man, no work for his deep mind, no home for him. It is this history you have promised to carry on from this military burial when you take the American flag from your grandfather Jackson's coffin. This is our history. This is our responsibility. This flag comes with a sad and yet finally triumphant story. It's the dream. And you, our first child, our son, must carry the dream, remembering that the fight will not be won with a gun, remembering that a flag, a nation, can't contain the human dream, remembering that your grandfather, my father, comes from a long line of soldiers, and we still don't have justice, though their faith has brought us strong, ready, loving, and loved to this point, to Arlington, where we lay my father's body over the body of his brother in this graveyard of soldiers, where you must see and remember what we have lost and what we have won, and reimagine this fight and this dream for true freedom. With so much love, my baby, with so much love.
Gail Jackson, reading her letter to her nephew, dear nephew. This at the event Mother Courage, Imagining Peace in Support of the Women and Children of Afghanistan. You can go to madre.org. In a minute, we go to Blanche Wiesen Cook. You can also go to our website at democracynow.org or mail us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Now to historian Blanche Wiesen Cook, reading from her book, Eleanor Roosevelt.
1952, Eleanor Roosevelt toured India and the Awakening East, the title of her book. She toured Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, India, and Pakistan. She made this trip, she explained, because her United Nations colleagues were outraged when in 1950, the Children's Emergency Fund was ended. The US and its allies believed the emergency in Europe was over. The fund was no longer necessary. But her friends from Lebanon and Pakistan argued that the emergency continued. Countless children still starved. That had been the case for hundreds of years, the U.S. State Department replied. There was no emergency about it. When Eleanor Roosevelt's colleagues said to her, "You don't care about our children because they are not white," she decided to make that trip to see for herself. When she returned, UNICEF became a permanent agency. Her activist politics against humiliation and powerlessness were rooted in her commitment to dignity and decency for all people. She was convinced, as she said in 1934, we will all go ahead together, or we will all go down together. The day the atomic bomb was dropped, we came into a new world, a world in which we had to learn to live in friendship with our neighbors of every race and creed and color, or face the fact that we might be wiped off the face of the earth. Either we do have friendly relations, or we do away with civilization. We must wake up and see what we really want to do, we can do. After the UN General Assembly passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on 10 December 1948, she worked tirelessly for its adoption everywhere and wrote, "Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small they cannot be seen on any map of the world. Yet they are the world of individual persons, the neighborhood, the school, the factory, the farm, the office. Such places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere. Without concerned citizen action to uphold them close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the larger world." In Tomorrow Is Now, her last book, published posthumously, she looked forward. With proper education, a strong sense of responsibility for our own actions, with a clear awareness that our future is linked with the welfare of the world as a whole, we may anticipate that the life of the next generation will be more peaceful, more rewarding than any we have ever known. But for that to be true, we must resurrect the word liberal, which derives from the word free. We must cherish and honor the word free, or it will cease to apply to us. The vital power of ideas to transform society will prevail when ideas are faced with imagination, integrity, courage. Ultimately, the influence you exert is through your own life and what you've become yourself.
Historian Blanche Weisen Cook reading from Eleanor Roosevelt, her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. And now to the poet Sonia Sanchez at the Madre event several weeks ago in honor of to benefit the women and children of Afghanistan. Madre.org is their website. DemocracyNow.org is ours. This is poet Sonia Sanchez.
Ai Babo. Ai Babo. Praise God. One. There are women sailing the sky. I walk between them, they who wear silk muslin and burlap skins touching mine, they who dance between urine and violets, they who are soiled, disinherited angels with masculine eyes. This earth is heart symmetry, this earth of feverish war, this earth inflamed with hate, this patch of tongues corroding the earth's air. Who will journey to the place we require of humans? I grow thin on these algebraic equations reduced to a final common denominator, too. I turn away from funerals, from morning lightning. I feast on rain and laughter. What is this sound I hear moving through our bones? I breathe out, leaving our scent in the air. Three.
I came to this life with serious hands. I came observing the terrorist eyes moving in and out of southern corners. I wanted to be the color of bells. I wanted to surround trees and spill autumn from my fingers. I came to this life with serious feet, heard other footsteps gathering around me. Women whose bodies exploded with flowers for life. Life from curled embryo to greed to flush transistors, web pages obscuring butterflies. Our life is a feast of flutes orbiting chapels. No beggar women here, no treasonous spirit here, just a praise touch created from our spirit tongues. We bring the noise of mounting language. We bring the noise of Sunday mansions. We enter together, paddling a river of risk in order to reshape the wind, the sea, the sky, this dungeon of syllables. We have become nightingales, singing us out of fear, splashing the fair places with light. We are here on the green of leaves, on the shifting waves of blues, knowing once that our places divided us, knowing once that our color divided us, knowing once that our class divided us, knowing once that our sex divided us, knowing once that our country divided us. Now we carry the signature of women in our veins. Now we build our reconciliation canes in mourning fields. Now the days no longer betray us, and we ascend into wave after wave of our blood milk. What can we say without blood?
Sonia Sanchez. And that concludes our excerpts of the Mother Courage Imagining Peace event in support of the women and children of Afghanistan. For more information and to make contributions to the women and children of Afghanistan through Madre, you can go to madre.org. That's www.madre.org. And you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. And please email us at mail@democracynow.org. Also like to hear what you think are the biggest events of this year. Please call us and let us know what you think. We'll be playing listener comments at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. That event was recorded by Orlando Richards. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Lizzie Ratner, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Tell me what is war all about, and why must they kill against my will? I just can't figure it out. Oh, stop the war now. Good God, hear me say, don't put it off another day. Everybody says, stop the war now, 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 now. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. Dozens of international civilians traveling on a solidarity visit to Gaza are assaulted by Israeli military. We'll go to the border. The 22-member League of Arab States is threatened with eviction from its New York offices in the wake of the World Trade Center attack. But first, we continue our Afghan journey with Masuda Sultan. The Afghan-American woman has gone back to Afghanistan. Last night, she met with her family. 19 members were killed by a U.S. bomb on the farm where they had taken refuge. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan's the second. I'm Amy Goodman. New questions have been raised about the fate and whereabouts of Osama bin Laden after his face appeared on Qatar television yesterday. Al Jazeera station ran a preview of yet another videotape of bin Laden, which will run in its entirety more than 30 minutes today. Dressed in green military fatigues, a pale and gaunt bin Laden said he was speaking, quote, 3 months after the blessed attack against the international infidels and its leaders, the United States, and 2 months after the beginning of the vicious aggression against Islam. Several people, including Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf, have speculated he may have been killed in the U.S. bombing of the caves. Others believe he may have slipped away, possibly crossing the border into Pakistan. The U.S. War Department said it was not immediately sure what to make of the videotape showing bin Laden alive, possibly as recently as 2 weeks ago. As for the former Taliban leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, Afghanistan's new interim president, Hamid Karzai, says he believes he's still in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in separate news, Karzai has declared his support for U.S.-led coalition troops to continue to hunt for al-Qaeda leaders and bring them to trial. Karzai's government, which met for the second time yesterday, is pushing to put a multinational army in place as soon as possible. Afghanistan currently has no official army. Afghan officials insist it's unlikely that the Afghan government would lose tolerance for the continuing U.S. military presence, which includes B-52 bombers and other warplanes in the skies and U.S. Marines and special forces on the ground. But Afghan officials shed little light over continuing questions of U.S. warplanes' destruction of a convoy of cars last week in the eastern province of Paktia. U.S. military officials say those killed were al-Qaeda members, but there are persistent reports from local people that the dead were tribal leaders on their way to the new government's inaugural ceremony. This would have followed, well, a week before when the new leader, Karzai, was named. Just before that naming in Bonn, Germany, his headquarters was also bombed by U.S. forces. Meanwhile, the new government has promised to wipe out drug production and trafficking in Afghanistan, the world's largest producer of opium poppies. In their last year in power, Taliban authorities choked off most poppy cultivation in Afghanistan. But the U.S. is concerned that Afghan farmers, whose other crops have been decimated by years of drought, have already sown large amounts of poppy seeds for harvesting next spring. As soldiers mass along the border with Pakistan, India has dismissed the steps Pakistan has taken to clamp down on two radical Islamic groups that India blames for an attack on its parliament earlier this month. Indian officials have accused Pakistan of giving financial and logistical support to the groups, both based in Pakistan. The U.S. has added the two groups to the State Department's list of terrorists, prompting Pakistani authorities to freeze the group's assets and arrest one of their founders. But war fever keeps rising in India. For the first time in its 54 years as an independent nation, the army has canceled the Army Day parades that were to be held in cities across India on January 15th. An army spokesperson said thousands of troops who would have marched with tanks and artillery guns in a showy display of military might will instead be deployed along India's more than 2,000-mile-long border with Pakistan. Meanwhile, Secretary of State General Colin Powell has telephoned leaders in India and Pakistan twice each day. Today, in recent weeks, he has been urging them to calm the tensions that have continued to mount since the attack in India's parliament. According to remarks made by NATO Secretary General this week, NATO might support military action against Iraq if convincing evidence is found linking Saddam Hussein's regime to terrorism. Buoyed by the military success in Afghanistan, a growing chorus of Americans is now advocating Saddam Hussein be the next target, whether or not he had a hand in September 11th. Most argue that something like the Afghanistan model of training and equipping the Iraqi resistance while using American air power and special forces to support that resistance could get the job done. But others have said repeatedly that action against Iraq could be dangerous, if only because it may break up the so-called international coalition against terrorism forged after the September 11th attacks, not to mention the increased number of casualties that would occur. The chief prosecutor of the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague has said she is convinced there is now enough evidence for the former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic to be convicted of genocide. In a rare interview with the BBC, the chief prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte, said, "I'm convinced I can prove the guilt of Milosevic." She renewed her call for Milosevic to face trial on charges of war crimes in Kosovo, Bosnia, and Croatia at the same time, an idea recently rejected by tribunal judges. Vine of Happiness, Rotary Connection, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we go directly to Afghanistan. On the line with us, actually a satellite phone as they speed to Kandahar. We are joined right now by John Alpert, the founder of DCTV, Downtown Community Television, where we're based in the firehouse, blocks from the first Ground Zero. He has gone to Afghanistan with his daughter, Tommy Albert, as well as Masuda Sultan, who is an Afghan-American woman who's returned to Afghanistan to visit her family. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Well, hi, Amy. It's nice to be talking to you.
It's good to have you with us. I'm glad you're safe. Can you tell us what's happened since we last talked yesterday morning?
Well, we've had quite an adventure. We've been trying to get into Afghanistan all day long, and we finally succeeded about an hour ago, but it was quite costly.
In what way?
Well, they seem to have created a new industry of relieving journalists of their money. And when we came to the passport office, we were told that it was $200 per person to enter Afghanistan. Our driver was nice enough to bargain it down, so we only had to pay $500. But then they told us that we needed to hire security guards, and that was $1,300 a day for these rather unfriendly and not so trustworthy looking gentlemen who were standing around us with machine guns. So we managed to decline their offer and went down the road looking for somebody else who could escort us into Kandahar, and that's where we are. We're about an hour and a half outside Kandahar. It's really dusty, and I guess this is sort of a family vacation. I'm here with my daughter Tommy, and she can't wait to tell you what this ride is like.
Tommy, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Tommy.
Hi. So I just got a bloody nose trying to get our telephone set up.
Wounded in action.
And that's because of how bumpy the ride is?
The road is completely unpaved. It was paved for about 20 feet after we crossed the border. And ever since, it's really extraordinarily bumpy. We've been getting tossed left and right throughout the car. And there are a bunch of other trucks on the road, which we have to swerve around into oncoming traffic. So it's been a little bit less than fun.
Who else is traveling?
There's a ton of dust coming into the car, and we have our window open to receive. Sorry, what are you doing? Oh, sorry. We have armed guards in the car in front of us. We were required to hire them to protect us, and we have 6 armed guards. They suggested that we get 10, but we were able to negotiate and try to get the minimum of 6 since they're fleecing us for the cost of their aid.
Is Masuda Sultan with you as well?
Yes, Masuda is with us, and last night back in Pakistan, we visited some of her family who are refugees here from Afghanistan, and we had a pretty upsetting experience, and she'd like to talk about it, so I'm going to hand the phone over to her.
That was Tommy Alpert with John Alpert, a well-known filmmaker who is chronicling the travels of Masuda Sultan, an Afghan-American woman who lives here in New York, returned to visit her family in Afghanistan. Masuda, are you there?
Greetings from Afghanistan.
How does it feel to be in your own country?
I'm joyous and also anxious to see what we'll find in Kandahar, the city of my birth.
What happened last night? Can you describe your meeting with your family members in Pakistan?
I will describe it, but before I describe it, I just want to say I'm a bit emotional over what has happened, and I may not be as objective as I probably should be in describing the event.
We're not asking for objectivity.
We went over there last night. I had heard that there was some devastation. My family, I have some cousins that live in Kandahar, and the extended family is about 55 people. They lived right near some Taliban compounds and buildings, and they anticipated that once the U.S. bombing campaign started, they wouldn't be safe any longer where they were. They decided to move out to some farmland they had about 50 miles outside of Kandahar City, and were staying there in order to stay safe. One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside and realized that their area was being bombed. Some rockets hit nearby, and they decided they had to leave their rooms. As they were running outside of their rooms, some of them were wounded by rockets. Some of them were being shot at. They described the scene where they were running with their kit in their arms, dodging bullets left and right while they saw balls of fire falling down to the earth. They had no idea what was going on, and they were just running in any which direction for their lives. Some of them hid under an area that was covered, and some of them heard word of their loved ones falling to the ground as they were
We're talking to Masuda Sultan, who's describing how her family members were killed by the U.S. bombs that fell on the farmhouse they were taking refuge in outside of Kandahar. She's speaking to us from Afghanistan.
There were some women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't Al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country. The events of September 11th really made me angry, but seeing these people and what they went through make me angry as well. You know, they say that you have to break a couple of eggs in order to make an omelet, but when those eggs are your family, what can you do?
How many members of your family were killed in the bombing?
19 members of that extended family were killed. There were many women and children in that 19, and we were shown some of the pictures as well. And we met the children that became orphans or that lost their mothers. One of them was a little girl that was a year and a half old, and she had been drinking breast milk, and they were having trouble with her getting used to the powdered milk. But it's just, when you see the faces of those little children and they tell you the story of how their mother died on their lap with the blood flowing out of their head, and they ran for their lives, it breaks your heart. It breaks your heart to know that this is the collateral damage of war.
How did they make it to Pakistan?
Well, they described how they went back to Kandahar after the bombing, had to put the bodies on a tractor, what remained, and bury them closer to the city. They stayed in Kandahar for a few more days and decided to leave when they thought the roads were a little bit safer. They moved to Quetta, where they had some other family to receive them, and are currently staying with them in Quetta.
And how many were able to get out?
All the rest of them got out. It was just under, it was about 40-some-odd people that made it out. And some of them, about two people in Karachi seeking treatment for their injuries. We also met some girls that had been grazed by bullets. Little girls, 10, 12, 15, 16, that had small injuries of bullets just grazing their skin. It was unbelievable to hear and to see.
Are you glad that you have returned at this time?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Are you glad that you have returned at this time?
Am I glad that I've returned at this time? Is that the question?
Yes.
I don't know how to answer that. I woke up this morning crying, and I pride myself on not crying much. And I realized that if I had not come here, I wouldn't have to go through this. Obviously, it's a painful experience, but when I see what they've been through, I realize that I need to know what they've been through, and everyone else needs to know what they've gone through. And in that way, I'm glad that I'm here, and I'm able to tell their story, because it's one that definitely needs to be heard.
How did your family respond to you being an Afghan and being an American returning since they died under the U.S. bombs?
I'm not sure if I copy correctly. How does my family feel about this?
How did the family members you met with last night respond to you coming from the United States?
Oh, I see. Well, actually, I was surprised at the sympathy that they expressed both towards victims of September 11th and the hospitality they provided us, as well as Tommy, who was with me. And when I asked them about how they felt about Americans, they pointed out that Tommy, who was with us, was welcomed in their home, and that they gave her tea and cookies, and that they would offer the same hospitality to any American. They realized that this was some kind of a mistake, although they had a lot of trouble understanding why they were targeted. You know, it's very difficult to tell someone who's just lost their child or their children to shots and to bombs over their house that this was a mistake. So it was difficult for me trying to explain that as an American, our government probably did not intend to kill innocent people, that it was probably a mistake. It's a very difficult position to be in, and they asked me if I could get them an answer as to why they were targeted or who would have given them information about, information leading to someone thinking they were Taliban or Al-Qaeda.
Are you going to try to get that answer?
I will attempt to do that. I am not confident in what will happen as a result of my attempting to get this information or where I'll get with this. But they have asked me to do this, and I've told them that I will attempt to gather information in that respect. Another thing that I would like to do when I come back to the States is to set up a fund for them to pay both for the medical expenses they've incurred as well as the funeral costs. Now, I know that I probably won't be able to pay for everything, but I would like to contribute something to them. If the U.S. government isn't going to pay for it, then I'm hoping that some of the American people who have felt the same pain on September 11th that these people are feeling now will be able to help them.
Masuda Sultan, how old are you?
I'm 23 years old.
You now are on the road just an hour away from Kandahar, where you were born. What are your thoughts about going there today?
As I told you earlier, in some ways I'm extremely excited. In many ways, I'm extremely nervous. I don't know what I'm going to find there. The new government has taken control on December 22nd, and I'm confident that they will be able to keep peace and stability. That is very exciting to know that we can play music as we go through the streets, and I probably will not be wearing a burqa this time around. I was there in July and wore one. But I'm also extremely nervous about what I'll find in terms of the plight of the people and the stories that they'll have to tell me about what happened to them over the last couple of months.
Do you have many family members in Kandahar?
That is one of the other things I'm anxious to know, is how many people are still in Kandahar. I was able to meet up with some of them in Quetta, but I know that there's probably a few left in Kandahar. Some I'm sure are there. I'd also like to visit and see what has happened to it through all of this. And I'm sure we'll report back to you on all our findings in Kandahar.
Well, I thank you very much for spending the time with us today. As you drive with your satellite phone, the armed men in the next vehicle, Masuda Sultan, along with Tommy and John Alpert, driving from Pakistan, just made it into Afghanistan and headed to the city of Masuda's birth, Kandahar. Thank you, and have a safe journey. We will continue with Afghan Journey tomorrow on the War and Peace Report. Stay with us.
Listen to me. Whoa. It ain't nothing but a heartbreak. Whoa. Friend only to the undertaker. Oh, war is an enemy to all men. The thought of war blows my mind. War has caused unrest within the younger generation. Induction, then destruction. Who wants to die? Oh, war. Good God, y'all.
War. Edwin Starr here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Dozens of international civilians traveling on a solidarity visit to Gaza yesterday were assaulted by Israeli military. The group, which was part of a larger international solidarity movement delegation, had been walking peacefully from one side of the checkpoint to the other when the soldiers guarding the post forcibly stopped them. According to the travelers, with little warning, the soldiers began firing shots into the air, then descended on the group, punching the men and body slamming the women. At least one woman was later taken to the hospital. Members of the group were then dragged and forcefully thrown onto their tour bus. Two French civilians were detained. Prior to the assault, the international group had been planning to spend the day in Gaza, distributing humanitarian supplies and demonstrating their solidarity. They were scheduled to tour Gaza City, Khan Yunis, and Rafah, including the refugee camps. While they were initially processed and given permission to enter, the soldiers then changed their minds and blocked the group from going. It was at that point, the observers say, that approximately half of the delegation decided to cross the checkpoint on foot. The international group was comprised of women and men of all ages from the U.S., from Belgium, Britain, and France. We're going to turn first to Brian Wood, who was beaten up yesterday by the Israeli soldiers. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Brian.
Thank you.
Can you tell us where you are right now and speak up?
Yeah, we're in Bethlehem right now, and we're here at our base for all the activities for the International Solidarity Campaign this month.
What happened to you yesterday?
As you said, this is about half of the group of International decided to walk across Eretz Krasin after we were initially processed and allowed to enter, and then half the group entered into, they're actually inside Gaza. The other half were waiting outside Gaza when the Israeli border police decided that nobody could enter into Gaza. They cited a security concern that we would hear about later on the news. It seemed that they began to dramatize the situation around the checkpoint in order to justify their excuse for us not for them not allowing us into Gaza. For example, suddenly there were Israeli soldiers around the checkpoint that began shooting. One was shooting into a nearby Palestinian town called Beit Hanun. They also cited a mortar attack on the checkpoint while we were there as a security concern and a reason they wouldn't let us in. However, mortars are easily heard and make very loud explosions, and not one of us heard them. And even people in our group who have background in military services in their various countries were absolutely appalled that the Israeli border police cited a mortar attack on the crossing, on the Eretz crossing as a reason for not letting us in. So 35 internationals decided to walk across the checkpoint after we were processed through and then verbally denied access. The head of the international department at Eretz Crossing, Captain Joseph Levy, was one we were negotiating with beforehand. After he saw us walking across the border, he began to chase us down and said that if we did not stop walking, he would stop us forcibly and with violence. And we continued to walk, and after a couple of minutes, he began throwing people to the ground, punching people. I was punched in my face by him.
Was he there alone?
He was the main instigator of the violence against us. However, other border police were joining him, but not near to the extent that he was attacking us. Later on, he was also the same person who at least five times threatened to shoot all of us if we took even one more step further. One female in the group from Colorado actually was threatened at gunpoint by him when she refused to turn around. And Sarah, another member of our group, the one who was in the hospital, she was right in front of me when he threw her. She looked like a rag doll the way he threw her, and she landed wrong on her hip and is in the hospital for back and spinal problems. He continued to run to each person in the group and push one down, run to the next one, throw them down, run to the next one, choke them, run to the next one, and push them. He was running around like a crazy man. And even other border police and civilian police were trying to restrain him and verbally telling him to stop, and he continued with all of his actions. They confiscated all the cameras, video or still, that we had in the group as this was going on, so that we could not film their activities. They also ended up confiscating all the video footage, and we ended up sneaking away with a few still photos of everything that happened. We're waiting for those to be processed.
So did you ever make it into Gaza?
No. We were completely stopped from entering Gaza by the use of extreme violence, by shooting live ammunition all around us. At least 40 rounds were fired, and by several border police, including the head of the International Affairs Department at Eretz Krasin, Captain Levy, physically assaulting all of us. I've never seen so many old women body slammed by a young man in my entire life. I'm still dumbfounded that that he did this to these women, especially. And even several of the men in the group noticed that when they were walking with women, he would attack the women first before he would attack the men. His behavior was something that none of us could imagine. None of us would have ever expected. And it's also an unprecedented case that the Israelis did not allow internationals into Gaza. We've never heard of any case like this before in the past.
We're talking to Brian Wood. He's in Bethlehem right now. He's with a group called the International Solidarity Movement. Georgina Reeves is also on the line with us. They attempted to get into Gaza yesterday. You're with the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. You negotiated with the Israelis to try to cross the border and led the delegation. Can you explain how it was that you got permission to enter Gaza, and then how it was denied and what happened?
Sure. Well, we arrived in the morning a little after 9:30. There were two buses in total. Our bus
Georgina, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. It's just echoing. So if you can go as close to your phone as possible.
Okay. Is that better?
A little better, yeah.
Okay. We arrived at the crossing a little after 9:30. The bus with the American and British nationals on arrived first. The French arrived a little bit after us. We went in, the bus was taken to the VIP area, as it's called, where our documents would be processed, our passports were collected, everything seemed perfectly normal. There was nothing that suggested there was going to be any difficulty with this. The French group arrived as well, their passports were also taken. Their passports were returned to them first after approximately about 3/4 of an hour, and they still had our passports. So I was going in asking how long would it be, and same every time, no matter who I spoke to, it was, oh, just a few minutes, just a few minutes, just a few minutes. They were processing the passports. I saw them processing them. But still, the time got longer and longer. The French group had left. Their bus had been allowed to pass through the crossing and into Gaza. And then suddenly their story kind of started to change. And as I spoke to Captain Joseph Levy, he was saying, he was being very, very nice in his attitude, but was saying, I'm very sorry, there's some kind of security issue in Gaza, we're just going to have to keep your group here for a little while. And then that changed to, there's a security issue, we're going to be closing the crossing. Then it changed to, there's a security issue and we want you out the area. Now, I kept saying that half of our group has gone in. What is going on? And there were some inconsistencies in what was being said to us, because he told me that we weren't allowed in, but we kept saying, but you've allowed part of our group in. Why will you not allow us all in? Then he said to me, we're going to actually return the other half of your group to you, and sent buses out from the side we were, the Israeli side, to collect the French delegation waiting on the Gaza side for us. So they were then brought back. In the meantime, I'd managed to get our passports returned, but they'd actually stamped us out of Israel and then stamped us back in again, as if we had crossed and come back. And then they were saying that it was a situation, a security situation, they didn't want us in the area and that we would have to leave. And we weren't ready to do that. We were sort of milling around outside. And although they said, we want you to leave, we want you to leave, they then just left us alone. They didn't try and pressure us to leave at that point. Then, as Brian explained, they were citing a security issue with a mortar fire. And absolutely, if there was a mortar fired in that area, we would certainly have known about it. But they kept saying that there was danger and we had to leave, we had to leave. At this point, the group were obviously very, very frustrated. We were very concerned. We felt that they were, treating us very, very badly, and that there was absolutely no reason for us not being allowed through, apart from the fact that they just didn't want us to go through, and it was a totally arbitrary decision on their part. So approximately about 35 of the group said they wanted to continue with the trip, So they decided to walk through. The remaining part of the group who said they could return back to the Bethlehem area got onto the bus, and the bus drove out a little way from the Eretz crossing area. So the group started to walk forward, and a couple of us stayed behind the group just to observe what would happen. And as Brian described, the most horrific scenes of violence against completely non-violent civilians just trying to walk through the crossing occurred. And it was so shocking, I can't believe it still. It was quite incredible to see the behavior of the military against people just walking through. They were carrying their luggage, they posed no threat. And as Brian said, Captain Levy appeared to go absolutely balmy. He was crazy and he was very, very violent. And we've had some quite bad injuries, you know, from punches and from people being dragged about. And the distance I was away, I couldn't see completely clearly because they tried to move us back. But I could see people being very, very, very viciously manhandled and thrown onto the bus when they brought the bus down eventually to bring them back. The way they were putting them on the bus, I'm surprised there weren't any broken bones.
And what has the Israeli military higher up said about what happened to all of you?
Nothing. We've heard nothing. I mean, as you're aware, two of the French delegation were arrested, and their group, which is part of the GIPP movement, I haven't heard from them today.
What does that mean? The GI? Tell us what that movement is.
The GIPP is the Grassroots International Protection for Palestinian People, which is a similar kind of organization to the ISM, and it's an umbrella organization. It involves various different organizations like PINGO, which is a Palestinian network of NGOs in the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian Council for Justice and Peace, Sabil, Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center, and their group, that's who the French people are here with. And we joined with them yesterday on a joint solidarity trip.
Mary Thomas was on the line with you. But Brian Wood, as we wrap up this discussion, where do you head from here? How long are you planning to be in Bethlehem and the occupied territories, and where do you come from?
I come from Colorado. I've been here almost a year. I plan to stay here close to another year. We will continue our activities of nonviolent direct action against the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. We will continue as long as we can, as long as we're alive. We'll continue whether we're here in occupied Palestine or we're in our respective countries.
Has the Israeli peace movement made any statements about what happened to you, and are you holding a news conference?
The French delegation held a press conference today on the Mount of Olives. Despite intense media efforts...
This in East Jerusalem?
In
East Jerusalem?
Yes, in East Jerusalem. Despite intense media efforts, very little media showed up. Unfortunately, it was mostly just local media, so the word about this incident will not get out very far, even though it's a very significant incident of violence and the retraction of the rights of internationals to travel to Gaza.
Do you think it will scare young people who want to be a part of these kinds of actions? We saw it a lot in Latin America as well. American U.S. solidarity activists going down to bear witness. And when people hear about this, it makes them afraid. I don't hear you anymore speaking on the telephone.
Hello, can
yes,
you hear me?
I hear you, but I don't hear Brian.
This is Mary Thomas.
Mary, we're ending up in 5 seconds, but I just wanted to... You are also from Colorado?
No, I am from Lansing, Michigan. I'm here with the Michigan Peace Team.
Well, thanks for joining us. I was just asking Brian the final question. Do you think that this kind of attack on the group will discourage other young people from other places in the world and the United States from coming to bear witness in the occupied territories?
I would hope not, and I believe that because of what I've seen in the World Organization movement. The 20-year-olds, I've been in peace organizations now for 20-some years, and the 20-year-olds have so much vision, courage, and energy that I think things like this actually empower them more than scare them away. That has been my experience. I am really hopeful. A lot of us who have been longtime peace activists began to wonder if we weren't going to be dinosaurs and just left, you know, without anybody behind us in the last 5 years with the environmental issue and the World Bank and the School of America's. Our torch is definitely being carried by the 20-year-olds, and they're trained and they're committed, and I think actually this will inspire many more to come.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Mary Thomas of the Michigan Peace Team, Brian Wood of the International Solidarity Movement from Colorado, and Georgina Reeves with the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. You can get their contact information on our website at democracynow.org. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll find out about the Arab League and why they're being forced out of their offices in New York post 9/11. Stay with us.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land.
Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. That sung by Kim and Reggie Harris and Magpie in Concert. It was great to have Kim and Reggie in our Firehouse studio last week, just before the holidays. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The 22-member League of Arab States is being threatened with illegal eviction from the Manhattan offices it has occupied for the last 30 years. According to a lawsuit filed earlier this week, the landlord asked the Arab League to leave its Midtown headquarters about a week after the September 11th attacks on the Pentagon, the World Trade Center. The landlord claimed that other tenants in the building were worried that the group, which has observer status at the United Nations and has diplomatic immunity, would attract trouble. Now, after letting the issue lie for several months, the landlord saying the Arab League must either foot the bill for new security measures that were put in place after September 11th, or else it must clear out of the premises within the week. The cost of the bill is $79,000. However, the chief official of the Arab League, Ambassador Hussein Hassouna of Egypt, has said the group's lease is valid and it has no intention of leaving. The Arab League was formed in 1945 at the suggestion of Egypt to strengthen ties among the member states and win independence for all Arabs still under foreign rule. Today it represents more than 200 million people. We're joined on the phone right now by Ambassador Clovis Maksoud, the former Arab League ambassador to the United Nations. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Ambassador Maksoud. Ambassador Maksoud, are you there? Sounds like he's getting there. Ambassador Maksoud?
Yes, I can hear you.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Can you talk about what exactly has been said to the Arab League about why they have to move?
Well, first of all, the Sage company must have told them that they are concerned about the presence because it might attract attention. This is more or less giving license to all the hate groups to invite them to attack any Arab institution or organization in the Manhattan area. This is unfair. It is discriminatory. It is a violation. And I'm glad to see that the court yesterday made an injunction because made an injunction to stop the pending a judgment from the court next sometime in the new year. On the other hand, the lease has still till 2003. As a matter of fact, I did sign the lease in 1983, and therefore I think that this is not only illegal, it's discriminatory, and it is, let us say, politically incorrect. I mean, the Arab League is an institution of intergovernmental organizations. It has status in the United Nations, and I think that the headquarters agreement between the United States and the United Nations guarantees and ensures that within at least 20 miles, the United Nations is supposed to be protective and shielding all the diplomatic missions from any kind of adjudication. And secondly, and it's not only the Arab League in that building, it is also the United Arab Emirates mission, and both are being threatened to be evicted by the Sage company, and I think that the court has taken a correct decision in establishing an injunction, and that I am sure that the outcome of the whatever case might emerge in the aftermath of the beginning of the year would uphold the decision of the court that they are entitled to remain until the end of the lease. And as far as the insurances are concerned, I am sure that there is a reasonable invitation for to share in some part of the, but not to render the amount like around $80,000, which is totally unreasonable. That there should not be. This must be the responsibility of the Sage company and not of the participants and not of the those who are renting from it.
And where are the Arab League offices in Manhattan?
They're in 747 3rd Avenue.
Somewhat near the United Nations,
yes,
where a lot of the offices are.
All the offices are there, mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you facing pressure? I mean, you are the former ambassador of the Arab League to the United Nations, but are you, the Arab League, facing pressure in other ways right now? I mean, the word we have out of the Pentagon that has been floated around is that Afghanistan is just the beginning. I think it was Rumsfeld or the president himself who talked about the year 2002 will be a war year, that Iraq could be the next target, as if it hasn't been already a target for the last 10 years. What kind of pressure is the Arab League under?
Well, first of all, the Arab League, as you know, is the coordinating instrumentality of all the Arab states. Its headquarters is in Cairo. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, was the former foreign minister of Egypt. He's now the new Secretary General. And they are necessarily would want to protect all the national interests of the Arab states, including Iraq, Kuwait, others. The Arab League has condemned the attack on Manhattan in very strong terms. And there are many of the Arab states who are cooperating in the struggle against terrorism. Of course, there has been always throughout, at least when I was there, some crackpots sometimes try to threaten and make the hate phone calls. But this is part of the game, I guess. But I don't think there is any kind of threats on the mission itself. One cannot rule in 100% out, but I think that there is reasonable, and the United States government and the UN U.S. mission in the United Nations are aware of the implications of any kind of threat, even to those countries like Cuba or others who are not on very good terms with the United States. That the responsibility of the United States as the headquarters of the United Nations and as the custodian of international legal treaties with the United Nations is aware that these kind of pressures should not exist on the diplomatic missions. However, the Arab League itself, naturally, many countries in the Arab states are facing all sorts of political pressures, the Israeli and the Palestinian situation, the Iraq, etc. All these are things that have to be handled diplomatically, and I think that they are being handled diplomatically to the extent that nobody would try to provoke and damage growing understanding between the United States and the Arab world. Of course, there will always remain certain differences which have to be handled by the Arab League, and I think that's what's being done.
We're talking to Ambassador Clovis Maksoud. He is currently Professor of International Relations and Director of the Center for the Global South at American University in Washington, D.C. He, before that, was a journalist and is an author. He was the senior editor at Al-Ahram and chief editor of Al-Nahar Weekly in the 1960s and 70s. I wanted to ask about the latest videotape of Osama bin Laden talking about what happened on September 11th as the Blessed Terror, and Al Jazeera says that they will be running the full more than half an hour tape that apparently was mailed to them in Qatar from Pakistan today, sometime today. You have the U.S. press not airing the videotape as they did the first one, and you have Al Jazeera being bombed by the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, and then arrested was one of the reporters when he went to cover the Putin-Bush summit in Texas. Can you talk about the U.S. Approach to the bin Laden videotapes and what you think should be done with them?
Well, I think that I saw just one small part of the tape this morning on Al Jazeera. And I think that, you know, this whole idea now is being blown out of proportion. He's trying to repeat redundancies and trying to generate some sort of sympathy, which does not anymore exist. He cannot be the spokesman of Islam when we have seen how the people in Afghanistan have welcomed the new developments. It was such a wonderful sight to see some of the women in Afghanistan assuming cabinet status after having been marginalized and suppressed for the last 5 years. I mean, the Muslim community cannot be judged by a fringe group which perhaps at one time resonated with the negativeness of bin Laden because of the deep frustrations that were felt in many instances. But however, this does not mean that there is a sort of identification, either in the Arab world and I suppose also with the Muslim world. What there is that he is trying to hijack the grievances and act as if he's articulating them, when 99% of the population realize that however deep their grievances and frustrations are in the Arab and Muslim world, they have to be addressed in a much more rational, organized, systematic, and communicative manner. There is a distinction between genuine grievances that remain unaddressed and hate. And when he elevates the notion of terrorist acts, that some are benevolent, like the one they did in Manhattan and Washington, and the other and in Kenya, that I think is absolutely an indication of the dethronement of rationality. And I think that the people in general, when they realize that there is, at the end of the tunnel, certain outcomes that are justice, that leads to justice and peace, as it has done to some extent, not yet totally, in Afghanistan, I think that people realize that nobody can hijack their grievances for terrorist objectives.
And what about people here in the United States? The continued campaign right now against young, particularly Middle Eastern men between the ages of something like 18 and 33, the FBI, Justice Department now involved in the questioning of around 5,000 young people. Not clear how many people are being detained now. It is believed more than 500 people.
Well, I think that the United States, which is a nation of law and order, and nobody's above the law, but however, I think this dragnet is unfair to many, many, 95% of the people who have been inquired. It has a deep psychological impact, although from a on the surface it says that you don't have to attribute, but I mean, people realize, especially at that age, that they're vulnerable and therefore they have to respond to the FBI inquiries. And I think that this has created a great deal of anxiety in the Arab and Muslim American communities and among those who are residing here, especially that some of the people, some of the students, I mean, I know from my own experience, some of the students had to leave because their parents abroad were so worried about them, and the Arab students said they would like to stay in the same manner as there has been evidence.
At American University, have they given over the names of the Middle Eastern students?
There has been around 30 to 40 students who have left. No, have left the country.
And has the university been working with the government? This has been the case in a number of universities, but there's also been protests.
There have been many students in the university here who have been subject to, who have been called on to, you know, give their opinions or anything. I don't think so.
And what do you recommend to students when, if they are approached by the FBI?
Well, I mean, in one instance, somebody asked for my opinion. I said, go ahead and just answer what you know. Foreign students, for example, or those who don't have any citizenship, cannot not respond as such, because they, on a prima facie case, they would be sort of suspected.
But apparently among the questions are, give us the names and phone numbers of friends and family, which might concern some people.
Yeah, it does. It is. It's a deep concern, but I think that the ADC, American Anti-Arab Discrimination Committee, has informed the community and the Arab Americans and the Muslim Americans of their rights. And I think that this has began to subside because there has been unfair practices and also certain harassment.
Well, Dr. Maksud, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Sorry, we are out of time.
It's okay.
Dr. Clovis Maksud is former Arab League ambassador to the United Nations, now teaches at American University and runs the Center for the Global South. You are listening to the War and Peace Report, which was produced by Lizzie Ratner, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We are broadcasting from Downtown Community Television. I hope to be back with John Alpert tomorrow in our journey to Afghanistan. Free Speech TV, we're on channel 9415 of Dish Network, Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We thank them as well as public access stations around the country. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.